Hello again. Tonight, Ebony looks at two quite different but controversial issues. Are trade unions representing black workers? And how have Jamaicans reacted to the West Indian cricket tour of South Africa?
In a lighter vein, our music guest this evening is Carol Thompson, winner of the 1982 Best British Female Reggae Award. Tonight, she brings us her distinctive style of lover's rock.
But we start with the acquittal last Friday of black barrister Rudy Narayan, who was cleared of a charge of vilifying Britain's two top law officers. The charge arose out of a press release Mr. Narayan issued as the chairman of a political pressure group, Black Rights UK, after he had defended a black youth charged with the death of a white teenager, Terry May. In the press release, Mr. Narayan accused the Attorney General, Sir Michael Havers, and the Director of Public Prosecution, Sir Thomas Hetherington, of an unholy alliance with the National Front, and called for their resignations because of the massive damage they are doing to race relations in this country. The five-man disciplinary tribunal, led by Mr. Justice Stoughton, agreed that the charge, one of seven alleging professional misconduct, had not been proved. The issue centred on whether a professional could comment in a political context on the practices of his own profession. While acknowledging that the documents left a lot to be desired, Justice Stoughton summed up by saying, "We are not judges of good manners, nor are we here to interfere with free speech, unless the rules of professional conduct require us to do so." Rudy Narayan sees his acquittal as being more than just a personal victory.
"I think the most important consequence is this, that I know that the entire black legal profession was awaiting with severe apprehension and anxiety the result. Because if I had been convicted, a lot of them would have stopped associating too publicly with black defense groups or political groups or black groups in the community. Now they see that a barrister can criticize his own profession in a political capacity. It must act to encourage more black participation by black lawyers in furtherance of the struggle against racism and other matters affecting the black communities of England."
After his acquittal, Rudy Narayan joined members of the Society of Black Lawyers at a weekend conference, where they expressed opposition to the proposed police and criminal evidence bill.
"The Society of Black Lawyers felt, and have issued a statement to this effect, that the proposed new powers are nothing less than draconian and will inevitably lead to further conflict and confrontation in the communities. For example, a classic illustration of the new dangers proposed by this bill is the proposal that the police may designate a given area as an unsafe area, brackets in criminal terms. For example, Southall, Brixton and Hackney could be declared overnight by the police under this new bill to be heavy crime areas, and they could set up roadblocks all over the black communities. And if they do, this is a recipe for confrontation. The powers are absolutely amazing, and the right, for example, to look at confidential documents of doctors and solicitors on intervention into professional sphere, totally without precedent in Western Europe, as far as I know."
You have made criticisms about the British legal system in its relationship with black people. Could you expand on that?
"Once a community or a section of society believes, rightly or wrongly, that those charged with the protection and defense of the public interest, that is to say, the right of fair trial and the right to participate in the legal process with a sense of justice, once they begin to feel that, and I know the black communities do feel a great distrust, not only with police, but with an Attorney General, for example, who will not prosecute the National Front when they attack blacks. There are so many racial attacks where prosecutions have not resulted. This alone is bringing the legal process into heavy disrepute among the black communities, because the greatest single fear in the communities now is the fear of racist attacks and the confidence almost that those racist attacks may not be punished by police arrest and Attorney General prosecution."
In your view, what is the attitude of judges and magistrates to members of the black communities?
"They are suddenly learning very fast. Since the riots, they have become more amenable and, if I may say so, more overtly fair-minded. But it's a tragedy that it took the riots to educate the judiciary and magistracy of England. I feel that they are learning very fast and they are certainly are improving. But there's a massive amount of mileage yet to be covered by the professions. I see a need for the appointment of blacks to the ranks of Queen's Counsel, magistrates and judges. But though I see the need, I do not see the establishment wanting to recognize or acknowledge that need by the only way they can and should, that is by appointing blacks to judicial and magisterial positions. They are still reluctant, massively reluctant, to appoint us that reluctance has got to disappear. If it doesn't, then blacks are going to feel, both in and out of the legal profession, that includes black lawyers, that there is no proper place for them in society. And that's wrong, and that's dangerous.
Carol Thompson and Tonight. Politics and sport rarely mix, especially when the sport is cricket and the politics is that of apartheid South Africa. This January, Caribbean governments publicly condemned the West Indian team for playing there on the grounds that the visit broke the Gleneagles Agreement prohibiting sporting contact with South Africa. Juliet reports from Jamaica.
Cricket in the Caribbean is more than a game. It's a national obsession with players and spectators alike. From impromptu games with makeshift bats to organized schoolboy teams. The men that inspire them are national heroes. But recently, three popular test players were banned from West Indian cricket for life after Jamaican captain Lawrence Rowe took a Caribbean team to South Africa. Calypsonians summed up the reaction to this rebel tour.
Everybody talking about them rebels in South Africa. Yagara, West Indian storing the land of apartheid, led by Yagara. Backyard, some are cursed them. Backyard, some are praised them. Backyard, some are banned them. Backyard,
some curse them, some praise them. Reactions to the tour were divided.
Well, indeed and in truth, I think that the cricketers who went to South Africa have let down the Jamaican and West Indian community in particular, and sporting in the entire world?
Well, I feel that every man have a right, you know, because right now, for we Jamaicans to go over South Africa and play cricket, I don't feel really in South African sports should have anything to do with sport, because sport is sport.
My opinion is that it was wrong on a whole, for two reasons. They lied to the community and the nation by saying they were just going on holiday. And two, supporting the black man is important. And that's the first aspect any person should learn, especially young cricketers. And the thing that a captain who many young people, including myself, look up to and respect, would endorse nothing like that, it is wrong.
Well, everybody want to make a living, right? I don't disagree with them, because when you get old, just like a box out there, you don't have anything to get. All you have is a favorite name. So everybody have to look better, because nobody wants to stay in the slum.
What about the political aspect of playing in South Africa?
Well, I don't see nothing wrong with it.
Alan Ray, president of the West Indian Cricket Board, explains these mixed reactions.
I think a lot of persons feel, particularly those persons who themselves feel economically underprivileged, they adopt an attitude of, well, thank God somebody has got a fair amount of money. Unfortunately, I think that there are some of us who have to think on the matter of principle, and not only a question of whether somebody's pocket is now full of money.
For Everton Mattis, one of the rebel cricketers, the attraction of an estimated £50,000 was stronger than any matter of principle. Of the three Jamaican cricketers who went, Mattis probably had the least to lose and the most to gain financially by playing in South Africa. At 25, his future already looked uncertain when he was dropped from the Australian tour. He decided to take the money and face the inevitable criticism.
Everton, can you tell me, what were your main reasons for going to South Africa?
Well, my main reason was, as you're here, you see the conditions, what I live under. And it's a financial thing as well, but my main reason for going to South Africa is I'm an African, and I heard a lot about South Africa. So I personally went there not just to play cricket, but to see what is going on there.
And what did you see? What impression did you come away with?
Well, I think the news media, and overall, is giving the country a lot of bad name. There is apartheid system there, but it's not as bad as how the media make it looks to be. So I was going there to see, you know, whites on one side, black on the other side, but it's a far different thing. You know, black people, it's a struggle there, but, you know, it's a worldwide struggle for black people. So I don't see it any different from any other country. I came from a poor family, and I'm living in the ghetto. I'm a national representative, but I personally have got to see for myself, for the kids and, you know, my mother and my father and my wife and things like that. Well, I'm not a politician, I'm a cricketer, and I'm just dealing about the cricket. I'm not, you know, going into the political side of it at all. I want to keep far from that. You know?
But don't you think you've become political by going with the team to South Africa?
No, we went there as sportsmen to play cricket. So I don't think that that's part of the politics at all.
Well, sport became political when South Africa refused to allow England to take Dolivier to South Africa. And it's nonsense for people in South Africa to say that other people are bringing politics into sport. It isn't so. South Africa brought politics into sport on that occasion. When they take it out, then maybe, you know, the situation can change.
There is little evidence of political change. The South African government recently refused permission for the eighth time for Hassan Hawa, president of the non-white South African Council of Sport, and a leading opponent of apartheid, to come to Britain. Mr. Hawa had planned an open debate on racism in sport with Tory MP John Carlyle, a vigorous campaigner for the renewal of sporting links with South Africa. Mr. Carlyle, who has just returned from that country, wants to persuade the MCC to take a cricket team there this year. He claims that South Africa is complying with the Gleneagles Agreement by fielding multiracial cricket teams, while Hassan Hawa argues that there can be no normal sport in an abnormal society. Wayne.
As unemployment and the recession continues to bite deeper into the economy, Trade unions are finding the job of safeguarding the interests of their members increasingly difficult. Black dissatisfaction with the role of the unions in protecting their interests has a long history. How far have things changed since the 50s, when many black people faced open discrimination from management and unions alike?
The manager and house for, if he needed any porter, he told me that there was no vacancy for no porter. I asked him if he have any other space or job. He told me he have a job only to clear the rope from out the yard from 11 till 3.
Did you want to do that?
I decided to take the job. He said, not certainly up till now, he had to go and look. He went into another room and come back and told me that there was no vacancy at all.
Oh, there's no prejudice, Mr. Chatterway.
Why is it that they're not taken, then?
Well, it's the type of job done at a particular depot, you see. Speed is the question at a particular station, speed. And we are feel that the colour man is apt to work at one particular space.
But now, not every coloured man, surely, is much slower than every Englishman. You can't judge a whole race like that.
No, I'm talking now on a majority of the particular type of coloured man that I've contacted and that the staff at this particular depot have contacted.
That was 1955. Now, nearly 30 years later, have relations improved between the trade unions and the black workers they claim to represent?
I think that the unions are no good to black people. If you're black, the unions are not. And a lot of people might say, all right, you're just belly aching. It's not belly aching. It's having had personal experience of the situations that arise from which you get no...
64% of black workers join a union. Most of the men in this Coventry club are members and talk of indifference or even hostility at work. Whites are now chasing the dirty jobs that blacks used to do. If there's a dispute, workmates don't offer support, nor does the shop steward, who's almost certain to be white. There are very few black union officials.
Blacks have been here now for many years, and are members of the trade unions for many years. And there are many blacks in this country who have made themselves interested in trade union work, and there's no black person occupy any high position in the trade union movement.
I think that trade unions are racist, but can I say that trade unions are an institution within a racist society, and I believe that all institutions are racist, so by definition, trade unions will be racist because of the racism in British society.
But racism is very hard to prove. Ralston Deason is an exception. He objected to working next to a National Front member at British Leyland Land Rover plant. What help did he get from his union?
The shop steward intervened and the foreman. And after some debate, the shop steward says that if the National Front bloke was to move and not me, that there'll be some industrial action. And so under that threat, the management backed down, knowing fully well that I was in the right. Well, I took them to the tribunal and proved my case of discrimination.
I would say the reason why discrimination works within the trade union is because the trade union is a democratic group of workers. And the people who discriminate against the ethnic minority are the majority, the whites. If a decision is to be made, we are the minority, and so our votes do not really count. If you look at the number of union representatives within the trade union movement, our voice is very limited.
Most unions recruit full-time officers from amongst its senior members at a lay official or lay officer level, brown secretaries, shop stewards, etc. The question really is, why aren't there enough blacks in that position? And I believe that one particular reason for this is that this is a very lucrative job. We have some brown secretaries who get £3,000-£4,000 a year over and above their normal wages for being brown secretaries of a particular union. And they jealously guard these positions.
When it comes to an election of stewards, you know, the blacks are the minority. Nobody's going to, very few people will support a black for a shop stewards. Who wants a black to represent them? Very few people.
If there were black officials and delegates, they'd be here at the annual TUC conference. But for whatever reason, the lack of black faces is very marked. especially on the platform. 25 years ago, the TUC passed its first anti-racist resolution. 2 years ago, its Equal Rights Committee produced the Black Workers' Charter, a list of suggestions for dealing with the racist problems they know exist. But the TUC can only advise, not enforce, and union reaction is mixed. Bill Morris, the highest black union official in the country, explains.
The response has been mixed. I think it's true to say that the current survey shows that not enough unions have actually taken the charter on board in terms of real and positive change. But it's not a totally disastrous picture. A number of unions have now become aware.
The Black Charter is reasonable if you just want to deal in the world of words. But if you actually want to come down to do something practical, you've actually got to beef it up a bit with resources, because although the Black Charter is fine, it usually ends up in the rubbish bin when it reaches to the shop floor level. Now, what the TUC should do, the TUC should employ, for example, a race advisor who could advise the TUC on how to actually put the Black Charter in practice.
Some people reject it. Some blacks reject it because they don't think it goes far enough. They say it's not tough enough. Some white people don't accept it. They say, oh, that's just, you know, looking after the blacks, etc.
Does the TUC have any powers to enforce its recommendations?
The answer is no. The answer is we haven't got any sanctions. The only sanction we've got is informed union opinion. We can't shoot them, we can't thump them. All we can do is to get them to see the need for good trade union practice of this kind. The TUC's got to give a lead. I claim we have given a lead. We've not achieved half of what I'd like to see us achieve. But at the end of the road, in a democratic trade union movement, it is what the members actually do. And we can't force them, we can't compel them. We can shame them, we can educate them, we can organise them, we can explain the self-interest, but it's what the members do.
There's a feeling amongst blacks that the TUC is afraid of a white backlash if it's seen to be supporting black workers.
You do get a backlash. And unions have had this. In the post office, for example, on the railways, and there's been a reaction. And all credit to the unions concerned, they've gone right into the situation, straight back into the situation, and stood up to it. You've got to stand up to it. And so there will be reactions. They'll say, you know, what are these people getting preferential special treatment for? And you've got to make the point to them that this is what trade union is about, and it's not an issue of special or preferential treatment in the long run. It's a question of equal treatment.
The TUC's attitude is quite strange, really, because the TUC say in their various publications that they want to eliminate racism, they want to eliminate discrimination. They also recognize that racism exists on the shop floor, yet they seem unwilling or unable to put resources into combating racism. Now, the TUC, for example, are very much involved in the training of shop stewards. And for some time now, a number of various agencies have been asking the TUC to allow one specific day in a 10-day shop stewards course to be given over to race relations training. This hasn't happened so far. That's one sort of problem. The second sort of problem is that the TUC talks about equal opportunities. It advises unions that they should have equal opportunities policies, that they should ensure that their recruitment policies do not discriminate. And yet we find that the TUC itself doesn't actually carry that out into practice. For example, I have never seen a TUC advertisement for any of its offices in the minority ethnic press. I've never seen an advert in the West Indian World, for instance.
There is a feeling that you're not putting your own house in order. How many black workers do you have at the TUC?
Very few. At the moment, we've got a very slow turnover of staff. We are, of course, an equal opportunity employer. Okay, that's easy to say that, but we are, and we mean it. I have to be, because of people like you, people like my members. The answer is very few indeed.
To give us some information as to see what kind of positive action as they promised that they would take.
The Black Midlands Caucus at its monthly meeting. The growing anger has led to demands for separate all-black unions. But, says the caucus, this would relieve the TUC of its responsibility for improving the situation. A better answer must be pressure groups like this, drawn from many different unions but facing the same problems. They are determined to make the black voice heard and force changes on the movement from within.
I think that if the Black Caucus is going to do anything, we should start now looking at
how the changes we would like to see in the Race Relation Act. Because as far as the Race Relation Act is concerned, it's a joke when it comes to employment. All an employer needs to do is to refuse your job or dismiss you and go to tribunal and pay £50. I mean, it's cheaper to suck a black than to have dinner, lunch with the executive.
The Black Trade Union Solidarity Movement closed down the Nalgo conference last year. They weren't happy at how a particular motion was being discussed, and they objected to it, and the conference was forced to close early. Now the reason now that to me is significant. It was the first time that such a demonstration had taken place.
You need to educate the trade unions to recognize the fact that their membership is changing. The membership now reflects the multiracial society, and therefore the structure of the union must also take that on board.
Education is slow, but the education which comes from a man, a black man or a black woman, getting up at a branch meeting saying, this is how I'm being victimized, these are my rights, what would you do if I got a white face? That's education too, and people must ever forget it. It takes a lot of courage, but we're asking for a lot from our black members, like we are from our white members too.
When I came to this country, one of the first things I heard, learned to understand was that the trade unions were a protection group for workers. In the years I have been involved with the trade union, I have found that as far as the ethnic minority is concerned, we do not get the protection and the service that we deserve as trade union members. So I'm very disappointed in the trade union movement. And I see no hope, nothing that gives me hope that there is a likelihood of changes.
That report from Vince. Well, that's it for this week. Next week we meet Sam Springer, Mayor of Hackney, toaster Mikey Dredd, and attend a course in Liverpool on race awareness. But to sing us out, here is Carol Thompson, and she's Hopelessly in Love.
Hopelessly in love. Oh God, I'm hopelessly in love. I said I would never fall in love. Never fall in love again. Into this love, I'm falling, falling, I'm falling, and I don't know where I'm going. Sink into a love that's sweet and so divine. I just want you to love me all of the time. Hopelessly in love. I
RTV, a report on the Prince and Princess of Wales in